ॐ असतो मा सत्कमय, तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय, मृत्योर्मा अमृतं गमय, आविरावीर्मयेधि। रुद्रयत्ते दक्षिणं मुखं, तेन मां पाहि नित्यम्। मे द डिवाइन लीड अस फ्रॉम द अनरियल टू द रियल, फ्रॉम डार्कनेस टू लाइट, फ्रॉम डेथ टू इमोर्टैलिटी। May the divine consciousness fill our hearts and protect us. Very happy to be here and grateful to Swami Atmagyananda ji for giving me this opportunity to visit. We'll reflect in the next few minutes a little bit about happiness. If there is one thing about which we all agree, no matter from which part of the world we come from and what point in history we belong to, is that we want to be happy. Sometimes the question gets asked in religious circles, what the goal of life is. And those of us who have been reading books about Sri Ramakrishna, Holy Mother and Swamiji would naturally say, goal of life is God realization. But why is God realization the goal of life? Why would we even want it? But if we go to the bottom line, so to speak, what every one of us wants is to be happy. We don't want to suffer. We don't want pain. We want to be happy. Now, God realization becomes a goal only because then we believe, at least those of us who believe, that that realization of the self or realization of God will give me an unalloyed happiness. Happiness we have now, it's not as if we are not happy, but our happiness is punctuated with sorrow, pain, suffering, and whatever happiness we have is also very limited. So, it's what we seek is not just happiness, but happiness which will never end, and sorrow which will never ever be present in our life. And when we believe that God realization or attaining that spiritual ideal will give me that kind of happiness, then that becomes a valid goal. So we want to be happy. And I think, I'm assuming in any normal person would say, I want to be happy. We are also familiar, of course, with that famous statement in the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, they should have added women too, all men and women are created, I'm kind of editing it a little bit, are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those of us who have studied American history and the Declaration of Independence are familiar with these words. The phrase pursuit of happiness, there's been a lot of interpretation and discussion about it, and can be interpreted in many ways. Some people are not very happy with the phrase pursuit of happiness. Whether when we want happiness, should we pursue happiness? And sometimes this is called the hedonistic paradox, that if the more you pursue happiness, the more it will evade you. So whether pursuit of happiness itself will make us happy is debatable. What does make us happy is anything that we do or anything that we achieve is personally meaningful and fulfilling, then that makes us happy. But whether running after happiness itself will make us happy is very doubtful. And as I said, the happiness that we experience in life comes and goes. If you enjoy eating tiramisu, when as long as you are eating tiramisu, you feel happy, but it's going to end. And when it finishes, not only will your happiness come to an end, you will feel like, oh, I need more. And if there is no more available, then you're going to be miserable. And that's just one example. So all of the happiness that we experience in life is of this variety. On the other side, the same is true with sorrow as well. So just as happiness comes and goes, a sorrow in our life also comes and goes. If we look at our life, it's been a continual going back and forth between joy and happiness. There are things that make us happy, and then that effect lasts for a while until something happens and we are sad. Then that lasts for a while until something happens. So nature, in a way, is playing with us. Swamiji, Swami Vivekananda, said one place that nature comes and gives you a sweet, and you smile and you're happy. And then before you have had enough time to savor that happiness, the nature comes and gives you one slap, and then you cry, and so on. And so our freedom, our strength lies in not allowing ourselves to be manipulated by nature in that way. So if we take a look at our own life up to this point, a long-range view, and see how happiness and pain and sorrow have influenced our life, and what role, what is there any pattern in which we have experienced joy and sorrow? Now, some thinkers have done some research on this and have come up with different kind of formulations. One thing that we all experience in life is stress and anxiety. Sometimes it becomes so much a default condition of our existence that on those few occasions when we don't experience any stress at all, we might even wonder whether there is something wrong with us. And I'm not joking. There have been occasions when I have had some people come and say, "What's wrong with me? I've been just feeling just too happy." So and that's the sad condition, that we have gotten used to always being weighed down by some anxiety, some stress, that on those rare occasions when we are free from it, even for a short while, we are not even able to enjoy that because we begin to worry whether there is something really wrong with us. Now, speaking of anxieties, one other thing. How would we define anxiety? In the text called Panchadashi, but probably 14th, 15th century text, anxiety is referred to as poison. Just as you take poison, it just comes and corrodes and eats away the vitals within. Anxiety does that to us. It just completely depletes our energy. It weakens us. It makes us non-functional. So anxiety is some kind of a poison. And if we are always anxious, then there is a poison within our system. Fear. So how do we distinguish anxiety and fear? One way of distinguishing them is that fear has a definite object. For instance, now you can say, I'm afraid of snakes. So the fear of snakes that I have is there is an object, snakes. And so then I know what to do. If I'm afraid of snakes, if there is fear of snakes, I need to keep away from snakes. Exactly. There is a problem, I know the solution. Now, anxiety, as opposed to fear, does not have a fixed object. You're just anxious. And then you don't know what to do because there is no object with which to find a solution. And so one way of dealing with anxiety is to convert it into a fear. In other words, try to find out what is it that you are anxious about. And once then you kind of are able to find that object, then that anxiety gets transformed into fear. And then at least you have something to do with it. You may not be successful in dealing with it, but at least you know how and what you should do. So anxieties that we experience are of different kinds. And sometimes these anxieties, while can be isolated to different stages of our life. So sometimes it is suggested that the anxiety of guilt and condemnation is often, it often afflicts when we are young. So when we are young, the dominant anxiety that most people have deals with guilt and condemnation. The dominant anxiety when we are in the middle age, midlife, that is the anxiety of emptiness and meaninglessness. And some of us who are approaching that or there or crossed it are probably aware that there has been a phase in our life when things which appeared meaningful at one time do not appear meaningful anymore. That we suddenly start feeling empty inside. And sometimes that phase of life gets called as a midlife crisis. And then a third kind of anxiety comes in advanced years, and that would be the anxiety dealing of fate and death. Now, although I have identified these anxieties and related them to specific periods of our life, it's not necessary that, this is not a very watertight compartment. Any of these anxieties can come to us at any stage. But generally, it's possible to say that certain kinds of anxieties dominate us at certain periods in life. Young, when we are young, and all of us have been young, and many of us are young even now, is a time when it's a period of optimism, of golden dreams. When we are young, we feel nothing is impossible, that anything can be achieved. And as we get older, as we learn to apply reality checks, so to speak, then our dreams get a little bit tempered. Then we begin to realize that some of the things we felt when we were very young, it's not possible anymore. And so we then kind of keep on tempering our dreams. And in some cases, when we begin to see our dreams and hopes of youth just getting shattered, that none of the plans work out, it leads some people then to pessimism. In some cases, it leads to regret, to frustration, and in extreme cases, even into depression. So the period of optimism can lead to any of these different results. Or in some cases, it leads to just acceptance of the situation. That people are then realistic enough to say, sure, at one time I hoped I would be able to do this, I would achieve this, I would have this. It no longer seems possible, and I accept the situation. And that's what I refer to as this, the somewhat difficult period in the middle of our life, and which often gets called as a midlife crisis, although not all of us would see that phase of life, especially as crisis. We may not call it by that name, but it's more like I like this phrase, someone called it, it's the constant drizzle of disappointment. And so it may not come like one big shock, but one by one, we begin to see that the plans that we have are not going to work, or they have to be severely changed or curtailed or changed. So that brings me to the second part of today's title, U-curve. We know that the letter U, it just goes down and then it goes up again. So what has been found? Both, there has been an anecdotal as well as statistical evidence for this, is that after passing through a period when nothing seems to go right, when things appear to be pointless, meaningless, in most cases, a change seems to occur, that the initial disappointments gradually begin to disappear. There's one writer named Donald Ritchie, and he described this change, this transformation, in this way. He says, midlife crisis begins sometime in your 40s. When you look at your life and think, is this all? And it ends about 10 years later, when you look at your life again and think, actually, this is pretty good. So this change between is this all life is, and after a few years, you feel, okay, as it is, it's not as bad as I thought it was. It's pretty good, in fact. Now, there is nothing really mathematical about it. It doesn't have to begin at the age of 40. The period is not necessarily going to last for 10 years. But this is the general pattern. So one hopeful indication from this is that whenever we come to that stage, when things seem not to go as well as we thought, so don't think that it's all downhill from there. That at some point, the curve will go upward. That curve which goes upward from disappointment has been sometimes seen by researchers as approaching some kind of wisdom. Now, wisdom, I'm not really speaking it from some spiritual wisdom or anything like that, but just a wisdom that comes through experiencing life itself. The wisdom that comes through dealing with one's disappointments. The wisdom that comes through just the blows that we get in life. Which is why, normally, as we get older, we become more mature. We become wise in the sense that we have a more realistic expectation from life around us. So, a lot of studies have been done on this in the last 30 or 40 years. And what these studies have showed, that people's satisfaction with their life increases on average from their early 50s through their 60s and 70s and even beyond, until, doesn't last forever, until disability and final illness may change the situation in some cases. But in some cases, if everything has kind of worked out somehow ideally, then that sense of satisfaction and acceptance may last right till the end. Now, this has been confirmed through extensive surveys that have been done in most parts of the world, in developed countries as well as in developing countries. And that's what the phrase they have come up with, the happiness U curve. Now, we might ask ourselves, why is it that we work? All of us work. No one, as Krishna says in the Gita, no one can live without working. So, all of us work. Now, if we look at the primary motivation behind the work that we do, now why is it that we work? And most of us would say that we work to earn our livelihood, to pay our bills. But beyond that, what work does, it gives us the freedom to get what we want. Whatever we earn, the money that we earn, gives us the freedom then to go buy the things that we need, the things that we want, the things that make us happy. If we desire something, then if I have the means to get it, the means to buy it, then it makes me happy. So the link between work and happiness goes through this idea of wealth. So we work, we earn money, and then we become happy. This connection between wealth and happiness is very firmly embedded in our minds. Many of you will have heard the term that is often used in Vedanta discourse about Purushartha. And it is often said there are four Purusharthas. Now, Purusha is human beings. Artha literally means want. Sometimes the term Purushartha gets translated as four goals of life. They're not really four goals of life. These are the four things that people want. Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha. Righteous living, Dharma. Artha is wealth or money. Kama is enjoyment or desires, fulfillment of desires. And moksha is spiritual freedom. Now, as I said in the beginning, what we want is we want to be happy. Where we differ is, what is it that will make me happy? So some feel that the more the money I have, the happier I'll be. And that's the connection I was referring to. the connection between wealth and happiness, artha and joy. Some people feel, no, it's really the fulfillment of desires that is what will make me happy. And then kama becomes a purushartha. Some feel, if I hold on to the life of dharma, truthfulness, honesty, doing the right thing at the right time, that would make me happy. Then dharma becomes an artha, purushartha. And then some, of course, believe that no, just becoming free from this entire samsara, that's what make will happy. And then moksha becomes a goal. So these are not really four goals mandated by the scriptures. It's just a realistic assessment of what people think will make them happy. And so this connection between wealth and happiness is very firmly embedded in the minds of most of us in this 21st century. Now, in the 1970s, there was an economist named Richard Easterlin. He discovered, again, he also did very extensive surveys, and he found that beyond a certain point, countries don't get happier as they become richer. Well, the United States is one of the very prosperous countries in the world today. Can we say in all honesty that we are the happiest people in the world? Well, I got my answer. So wealth and happiness don't have a very natural cause and effect relationship. So once this was kind of confirmed, not just from our own life, and of course, we really don't even need to look at these surveys. Sometimes we can just look at our own life. We might have a lot of things, and yet we might be, not necessarily, but we could be, more miserable than someone who doesn't have the things that we have. So what we possess and how much happiness we have are not necessarily linked as cause and effect. So once this link between wealth and happiness is broken, then the focus changes. The focus turns to human well-being, not simply on being rich, but to making our life more meaningful, that we how the physical well-being, the mental well-being, the emotional well-being, the intellectual well-being, that becomes then of greater value than simply earning more wealth. It's from this way of thinking that a new branch of economics has emerged in recent decades. It's called the happiness economics, which studies the relationship between work and happiness. The work that I do, is it making me happy? So looking upon work not simply as a way of earning money, that more the work, more the money, but looking upon work, the source of happiness. Now, although this might seem to be a more recent phenomenon, it is not that. It's just that it's been put in a more scientific terminology, and the things have been quantified and measured. But Vedanta has known this for ages. In fact, the relationship between work and happiness, that's really what Karma Yoga is all about. Because everyone works. There is no difference. And as Swamiji points out, that most of us do just a slave's work. We work because we are being pushed from behind, and we are being pulled. So our hopes, our expectations are pulling us from in front. And there are so many factors, social factors, pressures from family, expectations from peers, our own ambition. All of these things are kind of pushing us, and we are being pulled. So how much of the work that we do, we are really doing it out of freedom? And how much of the work that we do, we are just being pushed? So coming back to this happiness U curve. So this experience that people have had, that the happiness goes on descending and at some point it goes up again, it's not limited only to human beings. They have done research even on chimpanzees and orangutans and found that even in their case, when they were younger and how they started getting older and how, and of course, those who researchers have worked with animals, they have ways of assessing how they become happy, because animals can get depressed too. It's not a surprise anymore, but at one time people would have been shocked. And people in India are shocked that when sometimes people here say, my dog is very depressed and needs to go to a therapist. But we know, those of us who have pets know that our pets have their moments of great joy. Pets do get scared, they get depressed, they go through a low phase in their life, just as we do. So that's what makes some researchers believe that this happiness U-curve thing is, because it's not limited only to human beings, it might have a biological origin. There is something physically within us is probably changing as we age, which is what is making these changes possible. So then, why is it that this U-curve occurs in the lives of all living beings? And we need not, for the timing, we can keep aside chimpanzees. Let's just think about, we are all human beings here. So why does it occur in our lives? One reason is what sometimes they call the selection bias. In other words, if you're just looking at it as a sample of the people, because all of these are just sample studies. So one of the things that is seen is that unhappy people tend to die sooner. It's a very general observation. And so people who are more positive, who have a positive outlook on life, tend to live longer. And so one explanation that is given is that because unhappy people tend to die sooner, they are removing themselves from the sample. And so the people remaining in the sample then appear to be more happy. So that could be one contributing factor to the U curve. A second reason, looked at it from a psychological point of view, that as people get older and their time gets shorter, they invest in what is more important to them, typically meaningful relationships. And as we get older, we tend to abandon all the superfluous, time-consuming pursuits. When we are young, there is no limit. We think we have infinite time at our disposal. And as I said, as we get older, we become more realistic. Then we realize, among this much time that I have, I need to prioritize. I need to decide that these things are more important to me. These other things, I don't have to do. Considering this, many people then tend to kind of recalibrate their lives, indulging in less of social competition and more in social connectedness. Because one of the things that increases our stress, our anxiety, is just being competitive, trying to be one up, to do better, to and not just do better, but make everyone see that I'm better. And when this competitiveness is consciously eliminated from our hearts, it removes so much of the stress and anxiety from our minds. And the more then we are able to focus on connections around us, sometimes we may not realize it, but the sooner we realize this, the better it is. Sometimes we may be so much consumed by our work, by our job, by the projects you're working on, you might be neglecting the people around you, might be neglecting your family, you might be neglecting your friends. And when these connections become loose, naturally, it does affect the extent of happiness, the inner contentment that people have. And so, the earlier in life we realize that it's not just work, it's about the people around me. They are of importance as well. And the more connections we are able to develop and maintain, that then becomes a support structure. The times when we feel alone, when we feel lonely, if we don't have this support structure around us, then it increases our pain, our sorrow, our suffering. So as we get older then, because we try to eliminate this competitive streak in our life and we try to focus more on social connectedness, we tend to experience greater happiness in life. Yet another factor is that goals change in our life. When at some point we might think, oh, I'm going to climb Mount Everest, and then later on, for one reason or other, I haven't been able to do anything about mountain climbing, then we have to be realistic at some point and say, probably in this life, I'm not going to be able to climb Mount Everest. And then to keep that as one of my goals then becomes unrealistic. So our goals change, and we tend to choose and select goals then which are easier to pursue, depending on our capacities, depending on our knowledge and our interest. Now, since higher expectations fade from our life as we get older, the sense of disappointment and failure, that fades as well. And that's true. The higher the expectation you have, you're setting yourself up for higher the disappointment. When you have a lower expectation, then your disappointments are also fewer. What it also does, again, not in every case, but in many cases, is that as we get older, we tend to focus more on the present. Again, I'm speaking about this middle phase in life. I'm not speaking about when we are very old. When, as I said, when physical disability or illness or terminal illness comes, then it's difficult to maintain this. It's difficult to maintain this when we are very young and just brimming, overflowing with energy. But this is somewhere in the middle when we tend to focus more on the present and say, how I can make my present activity, present relationships, present work more meaningful and more joyful. And this, all of these things then provide a better emotional experience, which is why then we tend to experience greater happiness. And that's how this U-curve functions. Now, besides the psychological changes that are seen, researchers have also found physiological changes as we get older, not surprisingly. So they have done brain imaging experiments on the elderly, and then they have showed that through those brain imaging experiments, that the elderly tend to show greater signs of wisdom. And by wisdom, again, I'm not using it in a very technical, spiritual sense. Wisdom as we commonly understand it. Things like compassion, empathy, good social reasoning and decision making, equanimity, tolerance, comfort with uncertainty, ambiguity. It's very difficult to deal with this when we are younger. But as we get older, as I said, life itself will mature us generally. Some people tend to remain immature all their lives, but they are exceptions. More or less, we tend to get more mature. And that's why sometimes it's told, and you might have heard this, that when we are very young, then we think, my parents know everything. My dad knows everything. My mom knows everything. Then in the early teenage years, then we think, there are some things they don't know. There are some things they know. Then after a few years, and then we feel, you're still in your late teens, you think, my parents don't know anything. They just don't understand. They're absolutely clueless about everything. And then, of course, when you go into the 20s and then you start your career, and then you kind of are into the real world, so to speak, and then you begin to experience some of the challenges and difficulties which you did not have to experience before, then you begin to remember some of the things that your parents have told you. And then that time you feel, yeah, I think they were right about some of the things again. And then when you are in a late 20s or early 30s, then slowly, as we get older, we begin to remember a lot of the things we learned in childhood, a lot of the things we learned from our parents or our grandparents or the mentors who raised us up. So this is the kind of change that occurs. So physiologically, we generally tend to become more mature. And that also is a contributing factor to the higher sense of happiness that we feel. Sometimes it is said that older people don't have $5 reactions to nickel provocations. Yeah, so our our responses become more balanced. So we don't overreact. In fact, this capacity to not overreact is very helpful in spiritual life. Among the seven qualities essential for developing bhakti or devotion, in Sri Ramanuja's commentary on the Brahma Sutra, Sri Bhashya, he says two of those qualities are, in Sanskrit, it's called anavasada and anuddharsha. Avasada means being morose. Anavasada means not being morose. So, always being sad and sorrowful, that's not a helpful state of mind to develop devotion, to develop love for God. So if we are spiritual seekers, we should not be always sad and morose. And this was one of the challenges Swami Vivekananda had when he came to this country, because in maybe in the 19th century and those early days, a spiritual person, a religious person was always serious. So long-facedness was considered a sign of spirituality. And as we know, those of us who have studied Ramakrishna's books, Holy Mother and Swamiji, there's so much of laughter, there is so much of joy. You read in the gospel again and again, all laugh. And it's so much fun. And Vivekananda used to tell so many stories. And so sometimes they asked Swamiji, why do you laugh so much? And then he said, we are the children of the ever blissful Divine Mother. Why should we be morose? And he says, I become morose sometimes when I have a stomachache. That's what Swamiji said. So, being joyful is an important quality for developing devotion. But it's very easy to go from one extreme to the other extreme. And that's uddarsha. And every little provocation, we just want to jump and yell. And then that's bad also. So, anuddarsha. So, not getting overexcited by anything that makes you happy, and getting over, like down in the dumps if something makes you sad. Can we be somewhere in the middle? Which is not to say that there wouldn't be any reaction. Of course, if good things happen, that is going to make you happy, and you have every right to be happy. So it's not that we are not just walls which will not react. So can we keep our happiness under control as much as we can keep our sorrow under our control? And the two are related. We might think, I need just the capacity to prevent my sorrow, but I should be happy. It doesn't work that way. If I can't control my happiness, I will not be able to control my sorrow. I should be a master of both. And both lead, in their extreme forms, both lead to pretty much similar results. And the example I often like to give is, since I'm from Boston, our examples tend to circle around the Red Sox very often. And as you know, it's pretty much everyone knows, for decades, for more than 80 years, they hadn't won the World Series. And then about 10 or 12, 13 years ago, they came pretty close to winning it. And everyone was hoping eagerly that they'll win it. And of course, the last minute, they just messed it up. And the fans were so sad, so depressed, that they, and our Vedanta Center, those of you who haven't been to Boston, is very close to the Fenway ballpark. It's actually, I can see it from the window of my room. So the fans were so upset that they went on a rampage. They just destroyed, they upturned cars, and the cops came, and there was a big scene, and a lot of people got injured. The very next year, they won. They won the World Series, and they were so happy that they went on rampage, they upturned cars. Research, seen to it psychologically, physiologically, every way, this is what happens. That's very true. But from a Vedantic perspective, it's still a curve. They're still going up, they're still going down. The only way we can be free from this, and the only way to be permanently happy, is to find happiness in the true self. After Sri Ramakrishna's passing, the urn which contained his ashes was kept. Swamiji used to call it Atmarama. the Atmaramas, and that's the frame that is used. Atmarama, being content in oneself. And if we are content in the true self, we are content with everyone and everything. Because the spirit in me, the Atma in me, is the Atma in everyone, is the truth that is behind this entire creation. When we are told, love everybody, well, there are billions of people. How we don't even know, we don't know most of them. How are we going to love people whom we don't know and whom we may never see? And it just, it's too much to go on individually loving people. It's not even possible physically. The only way to love everyone is to love your own true self. So, self-love and love for oneself have to be distinguished. So I'm not speaking about some kind of a narcissism, that one is just love with oneself. I'm speaking about the real self, the Atman. If we can discover that center of joy in our own heart, we will see that that is the one that brings us complete joy. Swamiji, one great quotation of Swami Vivekananda is this, which I love very much. It says, teach yourselves, teach everyone his real nature. Call upon the sleeping soul and see how it awakes. Power will come, glory will come, goodness will come, purity will come, and everything that is excellent will come when the sleeping soul is roused to self-conscious activity. It's in volume 3, page 194, if you want a reference. This last phrase, when the soul is roused to self-conscious activity. So whether we know it or not, we are that infinite being. But if we don't know it, then we haven't become self-conscious of that truth. But when we become conscious of that truth, not just intellectually, when it becomes our dominant identity, then happiness becomes a permanent state of our being. Now, what do I mean by the dominant identity? Well, what is our dominant identity? See, it's like this. We will know what's important to us in life if we ask ourselves, how do I see myself? For instance, we simultaneously carry a lot of identities. So someone were to ask you, who are you? That question can be answered in any number of ways. Most of us will just begin by telling our name, but we can answer that question in terms of for instance, I could say, if I'm a sports fan, I could say, I'm a Red Sox fan. So that becomes one of my identities. And of course, you are living so close to the capital of the country. So it would be not unusual to then speak about it in political terms. So one could say, I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican. That's an identity also. So simultaneously, and then again, there are these identities based on relationships. Simultaneously, the same person can be the son of someone, a political work, then I will carry that identity. I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican more often than my other identities, and so on. It's a little bit like those people who carry a lot of credit cards at the same time. But among these different cards that we carry, we might use, say, one card a little bit more than others, maybe because it gives greater benefits. So identity is a little bit like that. So depending on the context, the place, the people we're dealing with, we effortlessly change our identities. For instance, when you come to the Vedanta Center, it might be very usual to then you feel more, I'm a devotee of God, or I'm a student of Vedanta. Like that may not be the dominant identity when you go for work. Then that will be, depending on your work or depending on the place, your identity will keep on changing. Now, if we look at these different identities that we have in our own lives right now, we can ask, which of these identities I carry more often? In the 24-hour cycle, which of these identities is dominant? One of the identities we all of us share in common here is that I'm a human being. Now, because That's my dominant identity. Because we see ourselves as human being, we effortlessly see everyone as human being. We don't have to then look inside a book and say, who are these people? Oh, they are human beings. It's very effortless because I can see myself as a human being effortlessly. That is why I can see all of you effortlessly as human beings. When we say that everyone is a child of God, or and more specifically, we say we are children of Ramakrishna, children of Holy Mother. Now, that seems like a great, great way to express things. But even when we intellectually understand and emotionally accept everyone is a child of God, when we are dealing with real people everywhere, we don't always remember that they are children of God. The reason we don't remember that they are children of God is that I myself am not able to see myself as a child of God. So when my identity as a child of God becomes strong, become firm, becomes dominant, then it will become easier for me to see others as children of God as well. Similarly, we say, serve everyone seeing God in their hearts. Shiva Jnane Jiva Seva, looking upon everyone as an embodiment of the divine, serve them, that is Karma Yoga, easily said than done. The reason I'm not able to see everyone, the divine in everyone's heart, is because I'm not able to see the divine in my own heart. So everything, it's not just that charity begins at home, everything begins at home. So the more I'm able to see the presence of the divine in my own heart, the easier it will become for me than to see the divine in the hearts of others. At some stage, in some form of happiness U curve will occur in our life. But we can change that. We don't have to remain tied down to this curve. It's possible for us to not become victims of this joy and sorrow. It's possible for us to eliminate sorrow completely. Just one final thought. There isn't much time to go into this, but let me put it this way. While it's common to think that in life we have joy and sorrow, some of the greatest people haven't thought so. Buddha, well known, said life is suffering. He didn't say life is joy and suffering, he just said life is suffering. Krishna in the Gita, he says, Anityam asukham lokam imam prapya bhajasvamam. Having come to this temporary, evanescent world, joyless world, asukham, think of the divine. And these are very drastic statements. Even Krishna doesn't speak about a joy filled with joy and sorrow. He just said a joyless world. Now, if Krishna and Buddha were some people suffering from some depressed people and some major problems with them, we probably wouldn't have taken them seriously. But we see that these two people, especially Krishna among them, he was the most joyful of personalities that we come across. Now, why would such a person say this is a joyless world? What is meant is that underlying the joy and sorrow that we experience in life, there is a deeper sorrow. The sorrow, again with Krishna, janma mrityu jara vyadhi dukkha dosha anudarshanam, meaning seeing the defective nature of life itself, birth, death, aging, sickness, these are the defective things. So the human body is not a perfect product. Swami Vivekananda, when he was a teenager, once said, I could have created a better world. Normally, if the product is defective, we want it to be recalled. This product we know is defective, but no one really wants it to be recalled too soon. So, there is this, no one is exempt from death, from aging, from sickness, and from this perennial stress and anxiety and worry. Now, because these are perennially connected with the body and mind, the sorrow is pain is a defective condition of the body and mind. So long as we are identified with them, we are never going to be free from them totally. And the Vedanta solution is, dissociate yourself, dissociate your identification with the body and mind. Tell yourself as often as you can that you are not the body and mind. They are good instruments. Just like your computer is a good instrument, your car is a good instrument, you need them. But you are not your car, you are not your computer. Similarly, you're not your body and mind, but I am the spirit. The more I'm able to remind myself of my spirit nature, the more I'm able to remember that I'm not the body and mind, they're just the coverings. That is when the soul is aroused to the self-conscious activity. That is when we will experience happiness, a happiness which will never go away. May that happiness come in the lives of all of us as soon as possible through the infinite grace of Sri Ramakrishna, Holy Mother and Swamiji. That's my prayer.